Ayrım 7.
Of this, greatness of soul is to do in part with how to behave to one's social inferiors, and liberality and magnificence concern one's attitudes to one's wealth. Three of the other virtues have to do with what are sometimes called manners in polite society. Aristotle's social bias is thus unmistakable. This bias would not matter philosophically, but for the fact that it prevents Aristotle from raising the questions, how do I decide what is in fact included in the list of the virtues? Could I invent a virtue? Is it logically open to me to consider a vice what others have considered a virtue? And to beg these questions is to suggest strongly that there just are so many virtues, in the same sense that at a given period there just are so many Greek states. Aristotle's account of the particular virtues is preceded by an account of the concept of voluntary action necessary, as he says, because it is only to voluntary actions that praise and blame are assigned. Hence, on Aristotle's own premise, only in voluntary actions are virtues and vices manifested. Aristotle's method here is to give criteria for holding an action to be non-voluntary. The usual translation for akouspos is involuntary, but this is a mistake. Involuntary in English usage is contrasted with deliberate or done on purpose, not with voluntary. An action is non-voluntary when it is done under compulsion or in ignorance. Compulsion covers all cases when the agent is really not an agent at all. The wind carries his ship somewhere, for example. Actions can also be non-voluntary where other people have the agent in their power, but actions done under threat of one's parents or one's children being put to death are borderline cases. They satisfy the ordinary criteria of voluntary actions in that they are deliberately chosen. But no one apart from such special circumstances would deliberately choose to act as he would under such threats. In some cases, we allow the circumstances to be an excuse, in others not. As an example of the latter, Aristotle cites our attitude to the character of Alcmaeon in Euripides' play, who murders his mother under threats. Aristotle is careful to point out that the fact that I am motivated in some particular way never entails that I am compelled. If I could allow that my being moved by pleasure or for some noble end was enough to show that I was compelled, then I could not conceive of an action which could not be shown by this or a similar argument to be compulsory. But the whole point of the concept of being compelled is to distinguish actions which we have chosen on the basis of our own criteria, such as the pleasure we shall get or the nobility of the object, from those things we do in which our own choice was not part of the effective agency. Thus, to include too much under the heading of compulsion would be to destroy the point of the concept. In the case of ignorance, Aristotle distinguishes the non-voluntary from the merely not voluntary. For an action to be non-voluntary through ignorance, the discovery of what he has done must cause the agent pain and a wish that he had not so acted. The rationale of this is clear. A man who, having discovered what he has unwittingly done, says, "But if I had known, that is just what I would have chosen to do," thereby assumes a kind of responsibility for the action, and so cannot use his ignorance to disclaim such responsibility. Aristotle next distinguishes actions done in a state of ignorance, such as when drunk or raging, from actions done through ignorance, and points out that moral ignorance ignorance of what constitutes virtue and vice, is not exculpatory, but is indeed what constitutes vice. The ignorance which is exculpatory is that through which a particular action is done, which would otherwise not have been done, and it is ignorance as to the particular circumstances of the particular action. The examples of such ignorance are various. A man may not know what he is doing, and when someone tells of a matter which he does not know is a secret, and so does not know that he is revealing something hidden. A man may mistake one person for another, his son for an enemy, or one thing for another, a harmless weapon for a deadly one. A man may not realize that a medicine is, in this type of case, deadly, or how hard he is hitting. All these types of ignorance are exculpatory, for it is a necessary condition of an action being voluntary that the agent knows what he is doing. What is most worth remarking on here is Aristotle's method. He does not begin by looking for some characteristic of voluntary action, which all voluntary actions must have in common. He rather looks for a list of characteristics, any one of which would, if present in an action, be sufficient to withdraw the title voluntary from it. An action is treated as voluntary unless done through compulsion or ignorance. Thus, Aristotle never gets involved in the riddles of later philosophers about free will. He delineates the concepts of the voluntary and the involuntary as we possess them, and brings out the point about them that they enable us to contrast those cases where we admit the validity of excuses and those cases where we do not. Because this is so, Aristotle only raises marginally, in discussing our responsibility for our own character formation, the question which has haunted modern free will discussions. It is possible that all actions are determined by causes independent of the agent's deliberations and choices, so that no actions are voluntary. For Aristotle, even if all actions were somehow thus determined, there would still be a distinction between agents acting under compulsion or through ignorance and agents not so acting. And Aristotle would surely be right about this. We should not be able to escape his distinction, no matter what the causation of action might be. What does emerge about voluntary action in a positive sense is that choice and deliberation have a key role in it. The deliberation which leads up to action always concerns means and not ends. This is yet another Aristotelian saying which may mislead us if we read it anachronistically. Some modern philosophers have contrasted reason and emotion or desire in such a way that ends were merely the outcome of non-rational passions, while reason could calculate only as to the means to attain such ends. We shall see later on that Hume took such a view, but this view is aligned to Aristotle's moral psychology. Aristotle's point is a conceptual one. If I, in fact, deliberate about something, it must be about alternatives. Deliberation can only be as to things which are not necessarily and inevitably what they are, and so to things which are within my power to alter. Otherwise, there is no room for deliberation. But if I choose between two alternatives, then I must envisage something behind these alternatives, in the light of which I make my choice, that for the sake of which I shall choose one rather than another, that which provides me with a criterion in my deliberation. This will, in fact, be what, in that particular case, I am treating as an end. It follows that if I can deliberate about whether or not to do something, it will always be about means that I am deliberating in the light of some end. If I then deliberate about what was in the former case the end, I shall now be treating it as a means with alternatives to some further end. Thus, necessarily, deliberation is of means, not of ends, without there being any commitment to a moral psychology of a human kind. The form of the deliberation involved Aristotle characterizes as that of the practical syllogism. The major premise of such a syllogism is a principle of action to the effect that a certain sort of thing is good for, befits, satisfies a certain class of person. The minor premise is a statement warranted by perception that here is some of whatever it is, and the conclusion is the action. An example which, although its content is mysterious, makes the form of the practical syllogism clear is given by Aristotle. Dry food is good for man. Major premise. Here is some dry food. Minor premise. And the conclusion is that the agent eats it. That the conclusion is an action makes it plain that the practical syllogism is a pattern of reasoning by the agent and not a pattern of reasoning by others about what the agent ought to do. That is why a second minor premise, e.g., and here is a man, would be redundant and indeed misleading, since it would distract from the point. Nor indeed is it a pattern of reasoning by the agent about what he ought to do. It is not to be confused with perfectly ordinary syllogisms, whose conclusion is a statement of that order. Its whole point is to probe the sense in which an action may be the outcome of reasoning. A probable first reaction to Aristotle's account will fasten upon just this point. How can an action follow from premises as a conclusion? Surely only a statement can do that. To remove this doubt, consider some possible relations between actions and beliefs. An action can be inconsistent with beliefs in a way analogous to that in which one belief can be inconsistent with another. If I assert that all men are mortal and that Socrates is a man, but deny that Socrates is mortal, I become unintelligible in my utterance. If I assert that dry food is good for man, and I am a man, and I assert that this is dry food, and I do not eat it, my behavior is analogously unintelligible. But perhaps the example is bad. For it may be that I can provide an explanation which will remove the apparent inconsistency. How? By making another statement, such as that I am not hungry, having just finished gorging myself on dry food, or that I suspect that this dry food is poisoned. But this strengthens, not weakens, the parallel with ordinary deductive reasoning. If I allow that a warm front's approach causes rain, and that a warm front is approaching, but deny that it is going to rain, I can remove the appearance of inconsistency in this case, also by making some further statement, such as that before the warm front reaches, here it will be intercepted. So that actions can be consistent and inconsistent with beliefs in much the way that other beliefs can be. And this is because actions embody principles. It is in holding this that Aristotle lays himself open to the charge of intellectualism. To understand this charge, let us consider it first in a crude form and then in a more sophisticated one. The crude version of the attack is that made by Bertrand Russell. Footnote: An Outline of Intellectual Rubbish in Unpopular Essays. It is because his actions embody principles, conform or fail to conform to precepts of reason in a way that those of no other species do, that Aristotle defines man as a rational animal. Russell's comment upon this is to invoke the history of human folly and irrationality. Men just are not rational, in fact. But this is to miss Aristotle's point massively. For Aristotle is in no sense maintaining that men always act rationally, but that the standards by which men judge their own actions are those of reason. To call human beings irrational, as Russell rightly does, is to imply that it makes sense and is appropriate to judge men as succeeding or failing in the light of rational standards. And when Aristotle calls men rational beings, he is simply pointing out the meaningfulness and appropriateness of the application of predicates which refer to such standards. However, Aristotle is committed to more than this, for he has to maintain that men characteristically act rationally, and what this implies is that the concept of human action is such that unless a piece of behavior fulfills some elementary criterion of rationality, it does not count as an action. That is, unless implicit in the behavior there is a purpose of recognizably humankind, unless the agent knows under some description what he is doing, and unless we can detect some principle of action in his behavior, what we have is not an action at all, but merely a bodily movement, perhaps a reflex, only to be explained in terms of other bodily movements, such as those of muscles and nerves. That Aristotle is right about this appears if we consider another kind of criticism of his intellectualism implied in the injunctions of all those moralists who believe that reason is a misleading guide, that we should rely on instinct or on feeling. This appeal to feeling as a moral guide is central to the Romantic period. It emerges again in modern times in the appeal to dark, visceral emotion of D.H. Lawrence's Mexican period. And its most detestable form, it is expressed in the Nazi cry to think with the blood. But these injunctions are intelligible only because they are backed up by reasons. And these reasons are usually assertions to the effect that too much reasoning leads to a calculating, insufficiently spontaneous nature that inhibits and frustrates. In other words, it is argued that our actions, if the product of too much calculation, will exhibit undesirable traits or will produce undesirable effects. But to argue like this is to meet Aristotle on his own ground. It is to suggest that there is some criterion or principle of action which cannot be embodied in deliberate action, and thus that deliberate action would be to that extent irrational. And to argue thus is to accept, not to dissent from, a central thesis of Aristotle's rationalism. Does Aristotle in any case believe that every human action is preceded by an act of deliberation? Clearly, if he does believe this, what he believes is false. But he does not. It is only acts which are chosen, in a specially defined sense of chosen, which involves deliberation, which are preceded by deliberation, and Aristotle says explicitly that not all voluntary actions are chosen. What does follow from Aristotle's account is that we can assess every action in the light of what would have been done by an agent who had in fact deliberated before he acted. But this imagined agent cannot, of course, just be any agent. He has to be ο φρονιμός, the prudent man. Once again, translation raises difficulties. Phronesis is well translated in medieval Latin by prudentia, but badly in English by prudence. For later generations of Puritans have connected prudence with thrift, and especially with thrift in monetary matters. It is the virtue embodied in life insurance, and so in modern English, prudent has something of the flavor of cautious and calculating in one's own interest. But phronesis has no particular connection either with caution or with self-interest. It is the virtue of practical intelligence, of knowing how to apply general principles in particular situations. It is not the ability to formulate principles intellectually or to deduce what ought to be done. It is the ability to act so that principle will take a concrete form. Prudence is not only itself a virtue, it is the keystone of all virtue. For without it, one cannot be virtuous. A man may have excellent principles, but not act on them. Or he may perform just or courageous actions, but not be just or courageous, having acted through fear of punishment, say. In each case, he lacks prudence. Prudence is the virtue which is manifested in acting, so that one's adherence to other virtues is exemplified in one's actions. Prudence is not to be confused with a simple faculty for seeing what means will bring about a given end. Aristotle denominates that particular faculty cleverness and holds that it is morally neutral, since it is of equal use to the man who pursues praiseworthy and to the man who pursues blameworthy ends. Prudence includes cleverness. It is the cleverness of the man who possesses virtue in the sense that his actions always flow from a practical syllogism, whose major premise is of the form, since the end and the best thing to do is... It is a conjunction of a grasp of the true telos of man with cleverness. For Aristotle, the role of intelligence is to make articulate principles on which a man whose natural dispositions are good will have already been acting unconsciously, so that we are less likely to make mistakes. The role of prudence is to know how a given principle, which will always be of a certain degree of generality, applies in a given situation. There is therefore, after all, a point in the argument at which Aristotle clashes with irrationalists such as D.H. Lawrence and with Tolstoy. For Aristotle holds that an explicit and articulate grasp of principle will help to ensure the right sort of conduct, while Lawrence's praise of spontaneity and Tolstoy's adulation of peasant ways of life rest on the contention that being explicit and articulate about principles is morally crippling. This clash has more than one root. To a certain extent, Aristotle and Lawrence or Tolstoy disagree as to what the right sort of conduct is, and to a certain extent, they disagree about what the actual consequences of being articulate are. But once again, we must note that although one can be a Laurentian or a Tolstoyan without inconsistency, what one cannot consistently do is to offer an explicit and articulate rational defense of their doctrines. And the fact that both Lawrence and Tolstoy exhibited all the intellectualism which they used their intellectual resources to condemn strongly suggests that an Aristotelian position of some sort is unavoidable. Moreover, it is only when one is explicit and articulate about principle that one is able to mark clearly the cases where one has failed to do what one should have done. And because this is such a strong point in favor of Aristotle's position, we may well be puzzled that for Aristotle failure constitutes a problem. But it does. Aristotle begins from Socrates' position, discussed in an earlier chapter, that nobody ever fails to do what he thinks to be best. If a man does anything, then his doing it is sufficient to show that he thought it the best thing to do. Consequently, moral failure is logically impossible. This, says Aristotle, flies in the face of the facts. But for Aristotle, that men should fail to do what they believe they ought to do still constitutes a problem. His explanations are several. A man may, for example, know what he ought to do in the sense of being committed to a principle of action, but ignore his principle because he is not exercising his knowledge, as may happen when a man is drunk or mad or asleep. So a man carried away may do what in one sense he knows he ought not to do, or a man may fail to recognize an occasion as one appropriate to the application of one of his principles. What we need to underline here is, however, not the adequacy of Aristotle's explanations. We can set out a wide range of different kinds of case in which there is a gap between what an agent professes and what he does. What is interesting, however, is that Aristotle, and in this he is very close to Socrates, feels that there is something special to be explained in the facts of moral weakness or failure, that such weakness or failure constitutes a problem. This suggests strongly that Aristotle's initial assumption is that men are rational beings in a much stronger sense than we have hitherto ascribed to him. For the suggestion is that if men always did what they thought best, there would be nothing to explain. Yet any account of men as agents, which only introduces the facts of weakness and failure by a kind of afterthought, is bound to be defective. For human desires are not straightforward drives to unambiguous goals in the way that biological instincts and drives are. Desires have to be given goals, and men have to be trained to reach them, and the point of having principles is in part to detect and diagnose failure in the attempt to reach them. Thus, fallibility is central to human nature and not peripheral to it. Hence, the portrait of a being who was not liable to error could not be the portrait of a human being. The portrait of the Jesus of the Gospels needs the temptations in the wilderness and the temptation in Gethsemane in order that we can be shown, at least in the intention of the authors, not merely a perfect man, but a perfect man. Aristotle's half-hearted admission of fallibility is connected not merely with a philosophical blindness to the importance of this human characteristic, but also with a moral attitude to prosperity of a kind that can only be called priggish. This emerges clearly in the course of his account of the virtues. Aristotle's list of virtues falls clearly into two parts, a division obviously not perceived by Aristotle himself. There are, on the one hand, traits such as courage, restraint, and agreeableness, which is hard to conceive of as not being valued in any human community. Even these, of course, fall on a scale. At one end of this scale, there are norms and traits which could not be disavowed totally in any human society, because no group in which they were absent could fall under the concept of a society. This is a matter of logic. When Victorian anthropologists sailed round the world, they reported the recurrence of certain norms in all societies as an empirical generalization, such as a comparative anatomist might report similarities in bone structure. But consider the case of truth-telling. It is a logically necessary condition for any group of beings to be recognized as a human society that they should possess a language. It is a necessary condition for a language to exist that there should be shared rules, and shared rules of such a kind that an intention to say that what is can always be presumed. For if, when a man said it is raining, we could not have such a presumption, then what he said would not communicate anything to us at all. But this presumption, necessary for language to be meaningful, is only possible where truth-telling is the socially accepted and recognized norm. Indeed, lying itself is only possible where and on the assumption that men expect the truth to be told. Where there is no such expectation, the possibility of deception disappears too. Thus, the recognition of a norm of truth-telling and of a virtue of honesty seems written into the concept of a society. Other virtues, although not logically necessary to social life, are obviously causally necessary to the maintenance of such life, given that certain very widespread and elementary facts about human life and its environment are what they are. Thus, the existence of material scarcity, of physical dangers, and of competitive aspirations bring both courage and justice or fairness on the scene. These are virtues which, given such facts, appear to belong to the form of human life as such. Other virtues, again, appear unavoidable for recognition by any society in which fairly widespread human desires are present. There can be exceptions, but as a matter of fact, they will be rare. So agreeableness is a general human virtue, although we may come across an occasional people, such as the bad-tempered Dobuans, who may not rate it as such. But toward the other end of the scale, there are virtues which are more or less optional, so to speak, which belongs to particular contingent social forms, or which are matters of purely individual choice. The non-Aristotelian but Christian virtues of loving one's enemies and of humility, with the practice of turning the other cheek, appear to belong in the latter category. The English and much more Aristotelian public school virtue of being a gentleman in the former. These differences Aristotle does not recognize, and so we find side by side in Aristotle's list virtues, which anyone would find it hard not to recognize as virtues, and elect virtues, which are difficult to comprehend outside Aristotle's own social context, and Aristotle's own preferences within that context. The two Aristotelian virtues which demand attention in this respect are those of the great-souled man, megalomuhos, and of justice. The great-souled man claims much and deserves much. It is for Aristotle a vice to claim less than you deserve, just as much as it is to claim more. It is particularly in relation to honor that the great-souled man claims and deserves much. And since the great-souled man has to deserve most, he must have all the other virtues too. This paragon is extremely proud. He despises honors offered by common people. He is gracious to inferiors. He repays benefits so as not to be put under obligations. And when he repays a service, it is with interest, for in this way the original benefactor will become the beneficiary and debtor in turn. He speaks his mind without fear or favor because he has a poor opinion of others and would not care to conceal his opinion. He runs into few dangers because there are few things which he values and would wish to preserve from harm. It is because Aristotle conceives of him as not failing that Aristotle endows the great-souled man with no sense of his own fallibility. The great-souled man's characteristic attitudes require a society of superiors and inferiors in which he can exhibit his peculiar brand of condescension. He is essentially a member of a society of unequals. In such a society, he is self-sufficient and independent. He indulges in conspicuous consumption, for he likes to own beautiful and useless things, since they are better marks of his independence. Incidentally, he walks slowly, has a deep voice and a deliberate mode of utterance. He thinks nothing great. He only gives offense intentionally. He is very nearly an English gentleman. This appalling picture of the crown of the virtuous life has an almost equally distressing counterpart in one aspect of Aristotle's account of justice. Much of what Aristotle says about justice is illuminating and far from objectionable. He distinguishes between distributive justice, fairness, and the corrective justice which is involved in redress for a harm done. He defines distributive justice in terms of the mean. To do injustice is to have more than one ought, and to suffer it is to have less than one ought. And justice is the mean between doing injustice and suffering it. But when Aristotle comes up against the use of dikaios as meaning either fair or right or in accordance with the laws, he asserts without argument that although everything unlawful is unfair, everything unfair is unlawful. It is less clear in the ethics than it is in the politics that Aristotle is prepared to believe that the positive laws of existing states can be more than marginally at variance with what is fair and right. Footnote: Nicomachean Ethics, 1130b, Politics, 1277b. The laws aim either at the common interest of all or at the interest of those in power determined in accordance with virtue or in some such way, so that in one sense we call just anything that affects or maintains the happiness or the components of the happiness of the political community. Aristotle goes on to describe the law as enjoining virtue and forbidding vice, except where it has been carelessly enacted. And this must remind us of Aristotle's complacency with the existing social arrangement. It is perhaps no accident that he also believes that some men are slaves by nature. By contrast, Aristotle appears to advantage in his inclusion of friendship as among the necessities of the man who achieves or is to achieve the good. He distinguishes the varieties of friendship, those between equals and unequals, those based on shared pleasure, mutual usefulness, or common virtue, and produces a typical catalogue whose details perhaps matter less than the fact that the discussion is there at all. But the self-sufficiency of Aristotle's ideal man deeply injures and deforms his account of friendship. For his catalogue of types of friend presupposes that we can always ask the questions, on what is this friendship based? For the sake of what does it exist? There is therefore no room left for the type of human relationship of which it would miss the point totally to ask on what it was based for the sake of what it existed. Such relationships can be very different. The homosexual love of Achilles for Patroclus or of Alcibiades for Socrates, the romantic devotion of Petrarch to Laura, the marital fidelity of Sir Thomas More and his wife. But none of these could be included in the Aristotelian catalogue. For the love of the person, as against the goodness, pleasantness, or usefulness of the person, Aristotle can have no place. And we can understand why when we remember the great old man. He admires all that is good, so he will admire it in others. But he needs nothing. He is self-contained in his virtue. Hence, friendship for him will always be a kind of moral mutual admiration society, and this is just the friendship which Aristotle describes. And this again illuminates Aristotle's social conservatism. How could there be an ideal society for a man for whom the ideal is as egocentric as it is for Aristotle? The exercise of virtue is, of course, for Aristotle, not an end in itself. Virtues are dispositions which issue in the types of action which manifest human excellence. But the injunctions, be virtuous, be courageous, be great-souled, be liberal, do not tell us what to do in the sense of what to aim at. They rather tell us how we should behave in the pursuit of our aim, whatever it is. But what should that aim be? What, after all this, does eudaimonia consist in? What is the telos of human life? A claim which Aristotle takes with immense seriousness but nonetheless finally dismisses is that of pleasure. On this subject he has to argue against two kinds of opponent. Speusippus, who was Plato's immediate successor as head of the academy, had argued that pleasure was in no sense a good. Eudoxus, the astronomer, who was also a pupil of Plato, held by contrast that pleasure was the supreme good. Aristotle wished to deny the position of Speusippus without laying himself open to Eudoxus' arguments. His arguments for the goodness of pleasure, or at least for the goodness of some pleasures, are partly a refutation of Speusippus' position. To argue, for example, that pleasures are bad because some are harmful to health is like arguing that health is an evil because sometimes the pursuit of health conflicts with the pursuit of wealth. More positively, Aristotle points to the fact that everyone pursues pleasure as evidence that it is a good, and he advances another argument to the effect that pleasure is taken in what he calls unimpeded activity. By unimpeded activity, he means activity which achieves its end, which is well done. Everybody, he argues, takes pleasure in unimpeded activity. Everybody wishes his activities to be unimpeded. Everybody, therefore, must see pleasure as a good. But in fact, pleasure appears to be common to all forms of activity and to be the only factor common to all. Aristotle finds himself for a moment close to the position of Eudoxus, and some scholars have held that in Book 7 of the Ethics, this is the position which he in fact takes. But in Book 10, at any rate, he produces arguments against this Eudoxian position, although even here he is clearly puzzled by the relation of pleasure to the telos of human life. The reason why he is puzzled is evident. Pleasure clearly satisfies some of the criteria which anything which is to play the role of such a telos must satisfy, but equally clearly it fails to satisfy others. We take pleasure in what we do well, unimpeded activity again, and thus taking pleasure in an activity is a criterion of doing it as we wish to do it, of achieving the telos of that action. A telos must be a reason for acting, and that we would get pleasure is always a reason for acting, even if not always a finally conclusive one. Pleasure, too, is not only sought by almost everybody, and therefore appears to be a universal telos, but it cannot be a means to anything else.